This episode is brought to you by Windrose Recovery, a family of premier addiction treatment programs in southeastern Wisconsin. Privately owned, Windrose Recovery offers a full continuum of personalized care for those struggling with addiction, including the Manor for residential treatment, Midwest Detox for inpatient detoxification, and Windrose Counseling for outpatient treatment. With highly personalized treatment focused on trauma, Dr. Chantel Thomas and her expert team offer an authentic experience, creating the kind of deep emotional change that's crucial for long-term recovery. If you or someone you love is struggling with addiction, call Windrose Recovery at 414-409-5300. You can learn more about Windrose Recovery by clicking the link in the show notes or by visiting windroserecovery.com. Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of the show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are.
This is Alicia Crossley, and this is The Path to Authenticity.
Nowhere to run, nothing to hide from the government's prying eye. Take yourself a summer holiday.
The Path to Authenticity proudly supports the I Speak Media Foundation, advancing media literacy education through an evolving series of outreach programs within the communities that need it most. For more information, visit ispeakmedia.org. Your first time here, thanks for checking it out. If not, thanks for coming back. I'm Tom Gentry, and this is The Path to Authenticity. Episode 121 for May 4th, 2021. It's part two of my conversation with the podcaster, photographer, writer, Alicia Crossley. This time last year, I was releasing episodes on Monday. So for the May 4th episode, I had sort of a Star Wars themed episode planned. I actually have a great nephew who wrote a musical about Star Wars. That's what it's called. It was an off-Broadway musical that was running up until the pandemic. So his name's Taylor Krausor. He's in episode 53. Great episode. Funny. You should check it out. But COVID kind of threw a wrench in that. So we had a hard time connecting. We didn't get it, you know. The musical had to shut down. Just like everything else. So as I record this, it is Saturday, May 1st, which is the 2-year anniversary of the podcast. Episode 1 with Lucia Capicchione was released on May 1st, 2019. And this has really been a blast for me. It's added a lot of value to my life. It's enhanced my life in so many ways, so many great relationships that I've begun to develop. I just feel like it's added so much, and I appreciate all of you who've listened to this. It's been great. So I have, in addition to this episode, being that next Sunday is Mother's Day, I did a Mother's Day sort of themed episode in that I did an episode with my mom. So that will come out on Thursday of this week. And I think this episode is a great prelude to that. In addition to Alicia talking a lot about her childhood, her experience with her mom, we go pretty deep. We go really deep in this episode. We did in the first half of it, but even deeper in this one. It kind of led to her asking me questions about my life experience. So I talked about a whole lot of stuff. I talked about what happened with me as an emerging adult, sort of the process of becoming a sober man, how that unfolded. And so it just couldn't have worked out. I couldn't have planned it any better the way this episode sort of unfolds, and then that the next one will be the conversation with my mom and the way that that unfolded. I feel like they just weave together really well, and I couldn't have scripted it that way. So, thanks again for listening. This podcast has been great for me. I hope it's been good for you. In my mind, as long as I'm helping one person with something, put a smile on their face, make them feel a little bit better, make them feel seen, whatever it is, then I'm fulfilling my purpose with this. So here we go. I think if you like what I do with this podcast, you're going to like this episode and you're going to like the next one too. So I hope you enjoy it. Alicia Crossley.
This story is the story of how I grew up and remember my parents. And I have a very visual memory. And it's not anyone else's story. If anyone else wants to write the book about it, they can write their book, right? Mm-hmm. But it's also a very honest look at the things that everyone knew that they struggled with and went through, but not necessarily the things that everyone knew I experienced at their hand. And it's hard piecing these things back together and looking back on how did I feel at that age? Where were we? I've started with the facts. And that codependent element as a little girl, being afraid to be with my mother and afraid to be without her.
Right.
And she was my main caregiver. And she would tell me, if you tell anyone that you found these drugs, or if you tell anyone that this happened tonight, or if you tell anyone that we went here, you'll never see me again. Is that what you want? Do you want to be taken away and never see me again? And there's an element that even I thought, I want to be taken away. I want to go to my grandmother's. I always felt secure there. But as a little girl, as a child, there's this fear of losing your parent forever that, I was afraid of how she would survive without me. And I knew she wouldn't. So I feared that. I feared losing her forever, or the idea of her. And that immediate bonding of codependence, and she definitely mirrored that. I can totally see how that became the platform, foundation of how my relationships, friendships, everything moving forward, how I experienced loving someone and trying to prove myself to them.
Hmm. Yeah, I think you're talking about a trauma bond.
Yeah, that's it. That's a fun word.
Well, yeah. Well, think about being in your mid-40s and realizing, oh my God, I thought that was love my whole entire life. And now I realize that I don't know what it really feels like to, I mean, because it's so intoxicating.
I think right? that too, Tom, though, as you mentioned, being a lifelong learner, and this is something that I think, you know, what you're saying, like realizing this at, you know, in your 40s, there seems to be this idea that there's an age when everything that needs to be realized is going to be realized. Right, and, right. you know, like we're going to conquer it all. And it's going to be by this time period. And I think the idea of lifelong learner is such a positive concept. And we both agree on that. But there's also this element you have to accept that you're going to be proven wrong a lot. And sometimes about things that are really important to you. And you're going to have to relearn certain things. And, you know, that trauma bond, that trauma narrative, it's not something that I just get to check a box and say, okay, I immersed myself back in it. I know it exists. I mean, with every year that my children get older, and I think when I was 6 years old, we were sleeping in a park. And I look at my little girl, you know, when I was 6 years old, my daddy committed suicide. When I was 2 years old, my dad shot my mom 6 times in the back, and she was paralyzed like the rest of her life. And I think, how would I take care of these children if I was my mother? And again, that lens of humanity, like being able to see that. But my whole point being, we never get away from trauma fully. And I'm learning how to let that be part of the narrative, how to be healthy through it, and understand that it's never going to go away fully. These pieces that, you know, for you, as you said, your own realization, this will always be part of your story. And hopefully, and I'm certain with the knowledge you have now, moving forward into the relationship that you're beginning to understand you thought you had and didn't and would actually want, there'll be things that will pop up and remind you, and it'll always be there, you know? And it's bittersweet, I think.
Well, here's the real game changer for me. Those things that we carry around that get triggered, those heartaches, whatever you want to call them, the residual effects of the trauma, all that stuff. At some point, we're bad at feeling. And we're bad at feeling. And at some point, it has to be felt. We carry this stuff with us.
Yeah.
And for me, it was about making a decision to stop avoiding it. And when it comes up, allow it to come up and not suppress it. And sometimes that meant, can't break down in tears in the middle of a work day, but maybe I ought to set aside some time tonight to allow myself to do that. And I actually did it, you know? And now what has happened is those things that attracted me before, and, you know, when I'd ignore red flags and all that kind of stuff, I don't do it anymore.
Right.
And the only thing that's really different is I was intentional about feeling those painful feelings and not pretending they didn't exist.
That was the turning point for me. When I was 21, my mother died of an overdose, and I was in my first year of teaching, and I was also in grad school. And so I was hired in grad school to teach, which wasn't normal. And so I was actually a student teacher while I was truly employed by the local school. Like middle school. Mm-hmm. Given that, the reason why that's important is I could only miss 2 days, not like a normal teacher who had, you know, time, because I was still part of my grad school program. I only had 2 days that I could miss during my teaching. And I got the call at 9 o'clock on a Wednesday night from one of my cousins that my mother had been found in a trailer. And they believed she had overdosed. She had been there a few days and she was dead. And they just wanted me to know. And she and I had not spoken in a couple of years. And so there was this immediately, Tom. And I think, you know, with what you're saying, you can appreciate this. I had never, and it was a survival mechanism, I had never acknowledged the pain from my childhood or my parents' choices, for me, it was always something to overcome. Mm-hmm. And I was partially guided by the praise of those around me, you know, you're not like your parents at all. Look at what you've done. And this didn't even affect you. And I grew up hearing that and telling myself that, not you really probably like could benefit from sitting down with someone at some point, you know, it was like, good for you, like not letting anything affect you. And I was like, yeah, good for me. And so I sat at her funeral and I refused to cry. I remember, I just dug my fingernails into the palms until it was almost blood because I refused to cry for her. And even then, I didn't grieve my mother. I grieved the opportunity that she took with her. And it was the last thing she could take from me, the chance to have a relationship with my mother. And I don't know, and I can't, as I've been told in therapy, rewrite the narrative or write what could have happened. But you know, that the opportunity, the chance of reconciliation, her last choice stole that one piece of secondhand hope from me. So that day I felt it, but I buried it all back down. And as I got into parenting and dealing with a hell of a lot more, it naturally finds ways to ooze out, doesn't it?
It's like
you can only hide it so long, and then it starts bubbling up. And for me, it really, postpartum hit me horrifically after our first child, and seeing myself as a mother the first time and being able, I guess, to identify with her really for the first time, there was that element of, oh my gosh, I see her. And I'm still angry and I'm still mad, but I see her and I can see how hard it was for her given the things that had happened. And long story short, because I know this isn't the novel, but you know, I really throughout my life would not have labeled it binge eating, but because we weren't always didn't food accessible. Anytime I did, I began, you know, to hoard food as much as I could. And so through having our children and the stress of that, owning a business and, you know, trying to have a successful marriage, I started overeating, in the middle of the night. I would make boxes of mac and cheese at midnight, 1 a.m. when I was editing photos, and just eat and eat and eat because it was the one thing that still gave me comfort through the anxiety because I still wasn't acknowledging the real problem. This is funny. You'll appreciate this being the professional in this field. My general doctor she recommended gastric sleeve. I'd gotten to 250 and I'm 5'2", which so at 250 and, you know, at 5'2 is not really ideal for a lot of reasons, and blood pressure, prediabetes, a lot of those things are popping up at this point when I'm, you know, 29, 30 years old. And I thought to myself, you know what, I'm going to go to therapy. I feel like before I have this surgery, everything I've read, it really everyone recommends that you see a therapist before you go through with it. And I went in as if I was going on my shopping trip to Target with my list and sat down for the first time in therapy.
Let's check these things off. Doesn't work that way, does it?
Tom, I used my first therapy session like confession. And I'm not Catholic, but I would imagine it's a lot like that. And I went in and I was like, okay, here are all the bad things I remember. Can you sign me off now? Like, am I cool to go have the surgery? And I remember the therapist saying, not only have you put your inner child in a corner, you've taped her hands together and her mouth and told her she can never speak. And I was like, what the hell are you talking about? Like, I don't do what? Wait, what? No clue at this point on the terminology, right? But that's where it started, was really, like you said, learning that pain is there, Alicia, and things have happened because of that pain, and you cannot keep it pushed down forever. And we have to start sitting with it. We have to start courting this pain and understanding where it fits into this narrative. And that was hard for me, because in a way, Tom, it made me feel at that time like I was failing to acknowledge that their choices and my childhood at their hands affected me, because I was praised so much for it not having affected me. It really felt like admitting a huge, you know, I'm a failure now.
Well, you know, part of what was happening, I'm sure too, is, and I only know this because I've done this in different ways myself.
Yeah.
And I had to have a therapist point it out to me. We, you know, we go through these things with our families, and then, you know, we say to ourselves, well, I'm never going to be like that. And for you, it was instead, I'm going to get great grades, and everybody's going to say, wow, you did that in spite of them. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
And really what you're doing is living in reaction to them.
Yeah.
And it's not, you know, I had a therapist say to me when it comes to parenting, not being them isn't the same as you being you. They're two different things.
That is so good.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm writing it down. I love that.
Well, and it's true, because for me it was, you know, I got the answer no a lot. So I taught myself not to ask for anything. So for a long time, my son, until I caught on, when he'd say, hey, can we go do this, or can we get that? And, you know, my inside, I would hear now you say yes, because he would say no.
Yeah.
You know, and to just try to be different than them, because I wanted him to have a better childhood than I had. And, you know, that's a lot of pressure. And you know, what I learned over time is that it was pressure I was putting on him too.
Sure.
You know, I was trying to be so close to him because I wasn't close to my dad, that's that can be suffocating, you know, and they just need us to be there for them. Right. That's our job.
That's definitely the hardest part of the season I'm in now, is, especially, you know, we're talking about how these different memories can pop up at different times. And I'm basically like digging this wound back open to look around as I write this book. And, you know, that's difficult, to be honest. And there are a lot of times I'm marking out to sit with these feelings as I explore it. But one of the big things is looking at my children and, thinking, you know, am I doing the right thing? Like, I don't know if I'm doing it for you.
Right.
Yeah. And nobody knows, right? Like nobody right. knows.
Yeah.
Of course.
I mean, it's I don't know the term I'm looking for, but you know, it's a living project kind of, you know, it's always changing, and we never know what the hell to do, and anything can happen. And, and, you know, and part of what we have to hang our hats on is, you know, you're not going to screw them up.
God, I hope
kids
not.
Are resilient. I mean, kids
they're
are resilient.
So resilient.
And my mom said to me one time, and somebody else said it to her, is that, you know, love fixes a lot of things.
Yeah.
And showing love. That's huge. That's really, really important, you know, and no matter what's going on with my son and I, if we're like, you know, right now he's 15, dad's not as cool as he used to be. We're not as close as we were, but we always say, I love you. Always.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm very expressive when it comes to that stuff. And even with friends, I mean, one of the things I've been talking about lately, a mentor of mine, I heard him say one time, before I met him, when it comes to love, if you don't show it, it doesn't count.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so, you know, I mean, I had a conversation with somebody today where I knew there was a chance that we were going to get cut off because I would have to take another call. And I just said, listen, I want you to know that I care about you and you're important to me. And, you know, yeah. And so, you know, I try to be the person who does that, who puts it out there and doesn't leave things like that left unsaid. And it makes a difference to people. It does.
It does. Makes a difference. Yeah. And the feeling of you knowing that you've put your true self out there. One of the people that it's actually our album company. He owns the album company. He's the CEO. But I would love for you to look at Sean Gordon. I interviewed him on a recent episode, and I just think you guys like would have the best conversation. So much of what you're saying, he has this great perspective as well. And I've learned so much from him, and also has a very comparable trauma narrative from his childhood and growing through that. And also addiction. And he talks about that openly on the episode that is under my podcast, but would make a great guest.
And say the name of your podcast for the listeners.
It's Imperfectly Polished as of now. When this comes out, it could be something else because we are working
on that. Well, there will be a link one way or the other.
We're flexing those lifelong learning muscles, and we think it might need to change to coincide better with our brand. But, you know, we'll figure that out.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, you know, the ACA thing is I would like to reconnect with you about that and talk to you more about that. You know, some of the things that you talked about, it's really about becoming our own. It's about reparenting ourselves.
Absolutely.
Us doing it. And it's, you know, it's not about judgment or anything like that, but, it talks a lot about inner child stuff and soothing that inner child and, you know, recognizing our triggers and all that. And you know, just to be among people who recognize that this stuff is going on in their lives and are showing up and talking about it and want to get better. And it's just huge. It is. And you know, one thing I want to say to you is that, man, I'm sorry. You know, the stuff that you went through in your childhood, you know, you're talking about tragic stuff and it breaks my heart. And you know, you're doing it. You know, you don't have to prove anything to anybody. You're doing it. And now you're using it to give back. And I'm excited to see what you write. And I have similar projects, you know, that are trickling out a little at a time. And I just, for me, one of the great things about writing when it comes to this stuff is when I put pen to paper, I reach conclusions that I don't reach if I just stay in my head.
Exactly. I want to thank you for saying that, Tom. Mm-hmm. And I used to, and I hope, I mean, we're on a podcast right now, but I cry a lot anyways. I'm just a very highly sensitive person and very like, you know, whether that's good or bad sometimes. But I feel the difference sitting here talking about my story now compared to 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. And even though I'm composed and, you know, I've had the breakdowns over the moments and I'm able to look at them now and see them, but still feel their impact. I'm not detached like I once was. And there are a lot of hard things, and there are times, and holidays are one of those for me, this Easter, just getting the things prepared for our children, you know, really looking at that and overanalyzing, you know, what are we putting in the baskets? What all are we going to have for the food? And, you know, I really feel like sometimes we have one little girl and she is the most like my husband, the least like me. And the girl is just, she's fierce. Like she's just already talking about not having to be them is not the same as being you. She is her. She loves cats. She's competitive. And I'm both in awe of her. And then also, how do I love this little girl? It's not the same way I wanted to be loved. It's not the things that I didn't have. And I'm learning that more and more. And a community like ACA would be amazing to have the support and to share the narratives that really bring us that continuous healing, I think.
Yeah. So looking back on it all, if there was one thing that you could say to that little girl that she needed to hear, what would it be?
Oh, you're going to make me cry. I'm already like teared up. It's fine.
Okay.
It's just part of but who I, let me who just I am point out. Person.
Let me just.
Yeah.
If you need to cry, it's because the tears need to come out.
Exactly.
Period.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter, you know? And,
So one of the things I've done for the book is I've written letters to that little girl and I've written letters to my mom. And, I plan on ending the book with a letter to my mom. And I write pieces of that as they come to my mind. But a big influence on what I've written so far has been because of what I've written to that little girl. And it's that you're going to make it, you're going to be enough, and it's not going to have anything to do with what you think it has to do with. Just breathe. Just try to be still. Get yourself to a place where you know you're going to be safe and you're safe within yourself and no one's going to be able to take that from you and no one is going to be able to decide that for you. I see her a lot. I go to a Reiki specialist and I don't know where you are with, I've had a Reiki experience. Okay. I'm a little woo, Tom. And, I talk to that little girl a lot during my sessions and I feel her presence and I see her over the course of this healing that has transpired and continues. I see her coming out of her shell. I see her hands being untied and coming out of that corner. And, sometimes I see her playing with my little girl at places where I grew up. And I realize that she's feeling more and more free as we do this work. And I'm really happy for her. And I just want to help her keep, you know, moving towards that, that place where she feels safe.
Well, you will. You're taking care of her. Yeah, the Reiki thing. So I was working out of this practice for a period of time, and they had a Reiki specialist who would come in once a week for clients. And I'd never tried it. And the woman who ran the business was like, well, I'm going to set a session up for you, you know, and we set up a time. She wanted me to experience it. And, you know, I'm laying flat face down on like a massage table and you know, if you don't know anything about Reiki, it's like they don't touch you necessarily.
No,
I mean, they may touch you, but you know, they're not touching you. But I felt the whole time where she was.
Yeah.
So there's that. And then, you know, of course they ask, is there anywhere where you've been feeling pain or anywhere where you feel like you've had tension or whatever? And at the time I didn't really feel that way, you know, and, but she honed in on my calf on one side or the other. I think it was the left and stayed there and worked it. And I was a bucket of freaking tears. Like, I mean, it just happened. It just happened. And obviously it needed to come out. You know, and that was near the end. And, you know, I just sobbed. And toward the end, it's like, do you want a hug? She said, and I was like, yeah. And, you know, and she just held me for like 3 minutes, you know. And in terms of woo, or you use that expression, I just think that in the West, we're missing a lot. You know, that the East has had figured out for millennia, you know, like, and one of the things that drives me crazy is that most Americans are so judgmental about it.
Yeah.
That if they realized how great the stuff is that, So, and I'm like, if it's a tool that'll help whatever, you know, let's bring it out.
That's exactly what I have found. And, you know, especially where I am though, Tom, like here in the deep South, and, you know, we have a church on every corner and we are believers. I actually am a Christian, but the thing that I love about energy work is, that's exactly how it's science. Like there's energy in the soil. There's energy in, and there's energy in my DNA from my parents. And this is something that has been a very healing aspect of this, is feeling them with me still and seeing how the brokenness and the things that they experienced and the choices they made, how I've been able to take those puzzle pieces and add puzzle pieces and create the picture that is one stepping stone closer to a generational difference in this trauma cycle, you know? And if I can just be one stepping stone, I don't have to transform everything. And I can see on their experiences in a lot of ways where they were that stepping stone from where they came from, you know? And so again, I have to go very carefully working with the energy aspect of it, because it is such a positive aspect, and really feeling the things and seeing the light. I think that's been very healing for me. But then also keeping myself grounded and rooted in the authentic narrative of the things that happened, and not trying to retell their story or reimagine their identity because of who they are within me now or how I feel them now.
Well, and where you end up is at the conclusion of, you know, as invested as I am in my story, I am not my story.
Yeah.
It's true. It's true. So, well, you know, I love your enthusiasm and what you're doing. It's, as somebody who, I almost drank myself to death, like at 23, and to go through such a monumental life change where it changed the course of my life. Like, and
what was a changing point for you, Tom? And I know you mentioned that your parents struggled with alcoholism too. You know, for me, I was terrified of drugs, but I didn't see the dangers of overeating. I didn't know that that is an addiction, right?
Yeah.
I didn't know the addictions of online shopping or the things that socially we kind of accept more so.
Right,
and so
right.
For you,
and there are a lot of them. There are a lot of them.
Yeah. And of course, at 23, I won't say like, oh, we just need to let that be a normal part of everyone's narrative. But I'm sure there was that innocent, okay, I'm 23 and I'm drinking. And, but I, not to project that on you, but I'd love to know what it looked like for you to, one, stand in line with that same choice. Again, I was terrified of making the choices they had made. And that's not a judgment thing. I'm just very intrigued of how that worked for you. And then two, how you realized that you were making those choices that were leading ultimately to your death if you didn't change.
Well, one thing I will say, my parents weren't alcoholics, but you know, I have siblings who are, and,
okay.
And I'm the youngest of eight, so I have much older siblings.
Oh, wow.
And one of them was my, older brother, who was my nearest brother in age, like 6 or 8 years older than me. And when I was in high school, he's a total mess. And I just went through high school telling myself I wasn't going to be an alcoholic like him. This is part of why I started this podcast, you know, because I didn't have the ego strength or the self-esteem to carry out a vision that I had or to use my voice and go after what I wanted in life, and instead did what I thought I was supposed to do. Mm. And pretty quickly ended up miserable.
Yeah.
And feeling stuck. You know, drinking was something that was acceptable in my family, for the guys especially. And, you know, by the time, so I didn't go away to college. I told myself I was going to take a year off before I started taking classes, and I was going to work my way through school. And I got a job in construction. And long story short, by the winter of that first year, I mean, it just hit me like, this sucks.
Yeah.
This is not who I am. It's not what I want. And I felt stuck. I mean, I didn't think there was, I just kept going with it, you know? And that was around the time that for the first time I consciously drank to change the way I felt. So if there's an invisible line into alcoholism, you know, that's probably where it was for me. You know,
I had a dear friend and I can't remember how she phrased it, but she said her daddy always told her, don't ever drink to feel better. Only drink when you want to feel the same that you do, whether that's from a celebration or whatever. Never drink to feel better, but only drink to maintain. And if you're reaching to feel better, that's, like you said, that fine line where we get messed up.
Yeah,
it's inherently
problematic. Yeah, and some people, I mean, you know, some people want to unwind and have a beer or a glass of wine or whatever, you know, and that's normal for plenty of people, you know?
Yeah.
And I would think like I would live like that, but I kept going, you know, there, I just, you know, I wanted oblivion and it just got out of control. And I was living with my parents and I was just really, really sad and it just kept going. And by the time it got to the point where I really needed to stop, there was no mistaking it, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I was binge drinking for days at a time. At the very end, I was working for this hardwood flooring contractor where we traveled and worked in malls. And I was home because we were out of material. They were waiting on a shipment. And I was home for like 2 weeks. And I did nothing but drink. You know, I'd get out in the middle of the day while everybody was at work or whatever and go get what I needed and I'd come home. And that's really all I did. I'd shove some food down my throat sometimes, but I just drank for days and days. And at the end, you know, I hadn't had a shower in several days. I'd been drinking whiskey for days. And I ended up, one of my sisters was, you know, she's worried about me, trying to get me to come to. I was like playing possum. I didn't want her to mess with me. And so, you know, she got scared and called an ambulance. And that happened four times that day. An ambulance showed up at my mom and dad's house. And finally, the fourth time, you know, they'd say, do you want to go to the hospital? And I'd say, no.
Right.
And finally, finally, the last time I went. And going back when I was a little kid, maybe third or fourth grade, I remember the teacher going around the room and asking us all what we wanted to be when we grew up. And this little girl named Angie Lee raised her hand and said, I'm going to be a doctor. And we went through school together. We were in gifted classes together, like, you know, and at 23 in an emergency room on a gurney, up walks Angie Lee.
No. Oh, wow.
Who says, Tom, what are you doing with your life?
You know? Man.
And then she didn't lead with that. I mean, she led with, oh, my God.
Sure.
And rubbing my forehead and just, I could feel the love in her hands, you know, just loving on me and so hurting for me. And, but I, you know, I knew that was God. I mean, there's no two ways about that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so I refused to stay. And they told my parents not to take me home, that I could easily go into an alcoholic coma.
Oh, man.
So my dad, you know, we got in his car and this is 96. So everybody didn't have cell phones back then. We get in the car and, he goes back inside the hospital and called the police and they rolled up next to his car and told me to get out and they arrested me for public intoxication.
Oh,
and
man.
I spent the night in jail. And by that first phone call in the morning at like 7:30, I called my dad and said, you know, I don't care where I go. I just need help. And I was on a plane by like 3 o'clock that afternoon. And I've been here in South Florida ever since, basically. I mean, and one of the last thing. One of my sisters and her husband took my mom and I to the airport, and my mom flew with me. Then the last thing my sister said before we got out was, just go there and do what the people say and get better.
Yeah.
And I did, you know, and I'm here to tell you, doing this kind of work for over 20 years, the people who get better are the ones who just do what they say. You know, it's like, it's so formulaic. You know, if you have cancer and you go to a doctor, but you don't do what they say, you're not going to get better. That's just the way it is.
And I think too, you know, and that's, God, that sounds so simplistic, right? And I know it is. And you've got to keep it that way.
It was hard.
Yeah,
too.
Exactly.
It was painful. And, you know, it took facing myself. That's really
what. Yes.
Yeah.
And you look at the people who don't choose to, or who don't do follow the steps, right? You said if you just do it, you get better, just like being a cancer patient. But why do some people who otherwise seem, right, that they want to live, you know, what lands those people back in rehab time and time again, right? Like, do they want to die? Do they not want to get better? Do they really want that life? Or, you know, I guess this is like such a loaded question, you know, thinking about that in addiction and how that plays into,
I think there are different answers to that depending on the person. And one thing I think is that it's probably easier for some people than it is for others. And I think I'm probably one of those people.
Yeah.
I tried and tried on my own for a long time, several years. I couldn't do it. You know, I did like an outpatient thing and that didn't stick. Once I went into residential treatment, I mean, I think part of it was I grew up in a home where, by God, you do what your mom and dad tell you to do. And I get into treatment, and my therapist picked up on that, and she'd say, I don't care if you want to do this or not, you're going to do it anyway. And I do.
Yes.
And that's, and it served me well, you know? Not kids aren't like that as much anymore as they used to be. So there was that, you know, I was used to that. And it worked. But the other thing is, you know, there's an expression, you know, people will say, you know, are you willing to go to any lengths? And I don't think it's that you have to go to any lengths, but you have to be willing to go to any lengths. And there are times when there are things that you don't want to do, like maybe really bad don't want to do. But you know you need to do it if you're going to be sober. And you got to do those things. You got to do them. And it's a spiritual malady. It's about connection. I knew before I got into any of it, the getting better part, I knew that I had to get right with God.
Yeah.
I knew that I wasn't, and I knew that I needed to reconcile that. And so when it came time, I was like, okay. And I remember literally like probably night two in treatment, getting on my knees at the foot of my bed and saying, God, I'll do whatever you want. Just don't make me be like this anymore. Don't make me do this anymore. And I've stuck to that. If I think there's something he wants for me, I do it, you know? So, and you know, my work, I take it as a privilege and I see it as God's work. Yeah. I do, you know, and it's funny, that another thing, you know, every mom, every Catholic mom wants one of her boys to be a priest, right? And so I remember having conversations about that with my mom when I was really little and deciding that when she told me that they don't get married, that I didn't want to be a priest. Before that, I thought I did. But once I realized they couldn't get married, and I remember saying that, like hearing it twice in the same week, but the Reiki master was one of them. I was talking to her about that, and she said, well, you are a priest. You're just not the kind they thought you were going to be.
Exactly. It's a little different, right?
It is, but really that's what it is. It's really that's what it is. That's, you know, I mean, no matter what you believe about religion or spirituality, what you call it, I use God because I can't think of an easier, simpler way to express it, you know?
Yeah, no, and that's like, I totally understand. And I think for me, again, you know, being a believer, but I know so many of my friends who believe in something and not, you know, but they're knowing, they're, you know, being that awareness, like being connected to that part of you that is so in tune with, again, not who you think you're supposed to be, but who you are and who you want to continue being and growing into.
Yeah. Well, and I think what I've learned more about all that in the last few years is that there's an illusion of separation between us and God. You know, we're all part of one whole. We really are. And God is in me.
Yeah.
And I am in God.
Exactly.
And, you know, it's not separate. And so when we can own that inherent divinity that we have and celebrate it and acknowledge it and recognizing the sacred in life. Life is sacred, and honoring it. And it's a little easier to believe in yourself when you know you have a flicker of God in your heart.
Absolutely. Right? And you know, and just like we said earlier, that story, it's not because I am capable, but because I've been given this story for a reason. And I know there's purpose in it. I know that there is healing in it, not just for me, but for others. And that in a way, that sacrificial element of acknowledging the trauma, not just for your own healing, but someone else, that definitely pushed me into diving into the depths of the trauma, that this could help others, that this could be something beautiful. And despite the broken, it could exist in a beautiful way. And I wanted that to be the legacy, you know, that my children learn. I want it to be what we leave when all is said and done, about how I remember things that were hard and ugly, but despite, right? Mm. And Faulkner, one of my favorite quotes, and I think this is kind of like how my favorite quote on, like, I use for relationships and marriage, but just in general, that we don't love because we love despite. Mm. And that's how I approach things now. And I used to, it was with me and with others. What is the reason someone would love me? Am I doing enough? Are they lovable? Are they, and instead of going around looking for those redeemable qualities, finding people that just you click with and, you know, have a shared narrative or have that shared experience and realize, yeah, we're going to love each other despite, and we're going to do the hard together. We're going to do life together. And I think understanding at 36, how much more beautiful and powerful that is than the perfect illustration I had in my mind, you know, as a child and teenager that I desperately wanted to be. It's just very, very different and complete juxtaposition.
Yeah. Wow. We could go on forever, but I really,
I've got like 24 more topics. So we'll just talk about when to do those. So,
this has been great. It really has. Yeah. And, you know, it makes me happy to hear, you know, that you're at this place in life. And, you know, I've said so many times to people that at some point you're going to understand this, it's going to make sense, and it's going to be something you can use to help somebody else.
Exactly.
You know, when you were talking about that, I was thinking about one of the most dramatic expressions of that in my life was maybe 5 years ago. I was working with this kid who was about 21 at the time, and pretty, he was an alcoholic, like he not maybe like he was,
definitely,
you know?
Yeah.
And really, like, just a sweet kid from the Midwest, just brokenhearted. You could just see it. And he was starting to talk to me about what his childhood was like, and he was telling me about his brother. And he described my brother, who was emotionally abusive with me, like, terrible. And, you know, one of the things I was able to talk to him about that maybe, you know, not just anybody could, is how when you love somebody so much and all you want from them is to just be able to love them and have you love them back, and they just treat you like garbage.
Yeah.
It's such a betrayal. It's heart-wrenching because you love them and you hate them at the same time.
Absolutely.
And it's confusing, and you know, like, who wouldn't drink over that? Yeah. Right? Like, come on, that's crazy. That's hard shit to deal with.
And you talk about that cycle, you know, and you can easily see that then from generation to generation, because that, for in my family at least, was what was repeated.
Yeah.
So my mother, you know, one of six girls, ages 8 months to 14, was left without a mother, and their father was just not there in the ways he needed to be, and there in ways he shouldn't have been.
Yeah.
And she went through that, dropped out of school at 14, got pregnant and married at 19 with me, started using at 14. And it's just, you see that cycle, and again, just that lens of humanity, right?
Well,
not an excuse,
suffering.
Not a past. Yeah,
is what it is. And you know, the reason why we can connect is because you're getting in touch with your wound, and I'm in touch with mine.
Yep.
And that's like, you know, it's it works. It does, and it makes life so much more meaningful too. It really does. So.
It definitely does. And it's so nice too, the things that I think, you know, growing up that I always hid and was ashamed of, that now are things that I can say proudly and stand next to and say, this is part of me. And if it's part of you too, in any way, or whatever your trauma narrative is, or, you know, that's okay. Like, it's, and that was the idea behind Imperfectly Polished, right? That you can show up and be successful and be awesome and take that mask off and also tell us about the brokenness.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going to work on that name a little bit more. I think there's something bubbling even better. So,
yeah. Well, I got to be on your podcast. I need you to come back when you publish this book and talk about
gosh.
It then. And this has been a blast. Thank
this
you
is awesome.
So much.
Thank you for having me on. And it was a wonderful experience. And just the conversation was very much put me in the mindset to go write some more. So thank you for that.
That's awesome. All right, there you have it. Two episodes with Alicia Crossley in the books. I'm really looking forward to the next episode with my mom. So one of the benefits of becoming a patron on Patreon is that you can hear these episodes usually 3 or 4 days before they're released. So by the time you're listening to this, the episode with my mom is available on Patreon if you want to listen to it. You can become a patron for as little as $1 a month. And it helps me with my mission of being able to devote more time to creating content with this podcast, reaching more people. Every little bit helps. So please support the show any way you can, even if that's just subscribing. You could leave a rating or a review at Apple Podcasts or Podchaser, wherever you listen. If you think someone will enjoy this episode or another one, you can send them a link. I try to make that really easy to do on the website, thepathtoauthenticity.com. So I want to thank punk rock opera, the band whose music you hear throughout the show. Their songs are used with permission from the artist and under a Creative Commons license. I want to thank Wendy Chin at Equivox, the folks at The Manor and Windrose Recovery for sponsoring the show. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, both at The Path to Authenticity. You can hear playlists on Spotify. We got all kinds of stuff out there. Starting to do a little more with Pinterest. And you can find me on Clubhouse. There's a link in the bio. I'm going to try to record shows with that app as much as I can so people can listen while I'm interviewing the guest. So anyway, this has been great. I appreciate you guys for keeping up with the show for these past 2 years. Thank you to Alicia. Hope you guys have a great week. Be nice. To Authenticity is powered by Equivox. For digital marketing and web design services, visit equivox.com.